Thinking aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is imagery and healing. With me is Dr. Jean Ochterberg, author of Imagery and Healing, as well as Women as Healers. Dr. Ochterberg is the president of the Association for Transpersonal Psychology. She's also on the faculty of the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology and the Saybrook Institute in San Francisco. Welcome, Jean.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
You have described mental imagery as being the process that mediates between our conscious intentions and the physiology of the body. Could you elaborate on that?
Jeffrey, I see it as an interface. It's been called a midwife that gives birth from inner experience to conscious expression. And if you look at the role of the image or the role of the imagination neurophysiologically and biochemically, it does indeed sit at the interface between emotions, between conscious thought and inner depth experiences.
Mm-hmm. Imagery has been used, has an ancient tradition going back 30,000 years or so to shamanistic practices.
Exactly. I really think that it's the oldest healing tool that we have. But it's interesting, it was only used for catastrophic disease, and it is still only used for catastrophic disease in the main.
Mm-hmm. You mean that it's not appropriate for more minor ailments, like if you have a cold or something?
I think it's extraordinarily appropriate for minor ailments, uh-huh. But I think there's a commitment involved, and there's a belief involved. And in many instances, we have quicker, more readily available medications for colds mm-hmm. and things like that. To do imagery as a medical protocol takes commitment, it takes belief, it takes some time out of your day. And most people aren't willing to do that until there's a sense of desperation that creeps in.
And there's often a sense we get when someone says we have a cold that even the cold is good, it's a healing process,
right.
You need to cleanse yourself of the
exactly.
fluids and,
exactly.
and so on. You don't want to interfere with a cold.
Or a fever.
Yeah.
Or even perhaps a headache. You know, headaches may be the end point of a whole series of things that are going wrong with the body.
Mm-hmm. Well, what really fascinates me is what a mental image is. And I think you really got your finger on it when you talk about the holographic model of, mm-hmm. of the brain, that mm-hmm. a mental image, it's not something you can exactly locate in terms of neurons firing in the shape of the image or something, but it affects the whole brain in a holistic sense.
In a holistic sense, and it seems to be evoked through the same channels that all the senses are evoked. So I think there's some public confusion regarding visualization and mm-hmm. imagery, because certainly the visual sense is used. But people that use imagery powerfully to shift their physiological processes and to shift their lives use auditory imagery, they use olfactory imagery, they use kinesthetic imagery, and they do something else that I think is very important. They are able to move mentally, move mind, move consciousness to a place in the body, which may be a sort of felt sense or a sort of kinesthesis.
Mm-hmm. In other words, some kind of an altered state that helps to mobilize the imagery.
Right. I think the imagery, I can't separate imagery from altered state.
Uh-huh.
I think that an altered state is definitely required in order for imagery to be healing or to be change-making.
Mm-hmm. You used the term, or refer to the term in the literature, the shamanistic state, or the mm-hmm. shamanic state mm-hmm. of consciousness, as mm-hmm. being a distinct state of consciousness in which imagery is activated and powerful. And I suppose it's related to a kind of attunement to the realm of mythos.
Attunement? Altered state, and it's another thing that discriminates it again from other types of altered states. It appears to be almost a bifurcation of consciousness. So that if, let's say, I'm working on healing my liver, mm-hmm. healing an organ, I move into that place as a shaman would move into the shamanic realms, but at the same time, I hold the consciousness that I'm using right now as you and I speak. So it's the bifurcation of being present and alert and awake at the same time, traveling into this invisible realm.
By bifurcation, you mean that there's actually, you might say, two modes of consciousness going on simultaneously.
Yes. And I do think that is almost the definition of a shaman. Mm-hmm. A shaman is not lost in the shamanic realm. A shaman is present in that realm and present in this reality also. Mm-hmm. And it's that quantum jump from getting lost in the inner world to being present in the inner world and present in what they call the middle world that I think is the shamanic challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And also what I see happening in my patients that are using imagery.
That they're able to walk in two worlds.
Walk in at least two worlds, mm-hmm. and know and hold the essence of their being, but continue to walk in these places that have no name.
Mm-hmm. Well, 10 or 20 years ago, a discussion like this would have been considered virtually beyond the fringe in terms of medical mm-hmm. practice. Now it's at least on the fringe.
Yes, or the frontier, depends on uh-huh. your perspective. Uh-huh. It was clearly, certainly within the last 150 years in Western medicine, beyond the fringe, but deeply embedded in the minds, I think, of good, caring physicians and psychologists and therapists and other people that listen to their patients and their clients. They've known this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on their fringe. It's integral to their practice.
And if one looks at the whole history of medicine, imagery mm-hmm. has been used virtually consistently.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in fact, in earlier cultures, tribal cultures, the individuals who had the most prowess with the image were the head healers.
Mm-hmm.
The bone setters and the herbologists were significantly below that individual in the healing hierarchy. So there was great stature awarded these people who apparently could see through the invisible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the exciting thing in our day and age, because I think we could say in our lifetime, the mainstream medicine kind of lost touch with this mm-hmm. tradition. You call it the golden thread, mm-hmm. I think, in your book. But because of research that has been done on fields such as psychoneuroimmunology, we now can say a great deal about how mental imagery affects our physiology. And I wonder if we could talk about that.
Let me start at a very basic and important level. And that's not the curative aspects of the image, but the types of imagery that are being done in hospital settings by nurses
mm-hmm.
who, in good controlled studies, have shown that if they can take their patients through a guided imagery prior to burn debridement, which is a very difficult procedure, prior to gallbladder surgery, pelvic examination, cast removal, on and on and on, if they can do a guided imagery, sometimes only one time mm-hmm. before that procedure, they have remarkably improved results. Fewer days in the hospital, quicker healing time, etc. The power of a prepared mind is absolutely astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going on at the bedside in major hospitals of this country. And it's very important that that ultimately be acknowledged as a nursing tool, as a tool for all caregivers who are by the bedside. Now, the aspect of imagery that has become controversial, stayed controversial, is the claim that it may have curative properties.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little evidence showing, correlational evidence, which means that the controlled studies have not been done yet, but there's correlational evidence showing that what a person images is ultimately manifest in their body.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if this is true, if this continues to be the case, and more studies come out, and there's hundreds of them now.
And you're talking about very specific kinds of imagery.
Very specific kinds of imagery.
Mm-hmm.
If this continues, then it has to be unethical to treat patients without acknowledging mm-hmm. the power of what goes on in their minds.
I mean, it's been known for a long time that the use of imagery in hypnosis can remove warts.
Absolutely. It should be a treatment of choice for warts. You know, no scars, no pain. But there are other studies that people have forgotten about. For example, you can hypnotize, or incidentally, I see not a lot of difference between guided imagery and the gentler kinds of hypnosis where
yes.
the clients are allowed to choose their own image. But There are a lot of studies showing that the people will develop hives, or the hives will go away. If you have people image saliva in their mouths, they have more saliva. If you have them image salivary IgA, which is an immune component, they have more salivary IgA. These are highly specific responses.
How do you image salivary IgA?
I have published that study recently. We did a nice controlled study with two groups of students, actually, and we taught one group everything that we could get our hands on about salivary IgA. So it's a wonderful Y-shaped thing. We taught them about its morphology, its mm-hmm. location, and its function, and then we made them a tape.
As if they could see it in an electron microscope.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. We also used cartoons and made it come alive for them. We talked about it was born in the bone marrow, or the cells that were born in the bone marrow, and then elaborated into the salivary IgA. So we gave them quite a bit of immunological information, gave them a tape with images on it. They listened to the tape for 6 weeks, and at the end of 6 weeks, they had significantly more salivary IgA. Well, we thought we were pretty smart, and mm-hmm. we thought they were pretty smart, and I found out that Karen Olness, who is a physician working with children, did this study several years ago with children. She uh-huh. talked to them about their salivary IgA, and it increased significantly. The importance of this is that salivary IgA is the first line of defense against respiratory infections. Mm-hmm. And children, when it's discussed with them, when they're given the images for it, know how to increase it.
Well, this is remarkable because it means that as we learn about the specific cells that fight mm-hmm. particular diseases, that we can develop imagery procedures to activate those specific responses. And I get the impression that you're talking about doing this in the absence of biofeedback.
Right. That's what makes it rather surprising. Now, we've replicated those studies several times. There's another individual, John Snyder and Wayne Smith at Michigan State, who've done their share of these studies. They're coming out of a very few labs, and that makes me a little uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I would like to see them replicated in mainstream laboratories all over the country. The interesting thing about those studies is, if we don't screen for belief system on the part of the participants, we don't get the results. Uh-huh. We have to say, do you believe this is a possibility? And if they say no, then they can't do it, or they won't do it.
I see. So you need to have people who already have a belief that it's possible.
Yes, that the mind and body are connected. Because basically this stuff doesn't happen overnight. They're asked to practice it for about 6 weeks. And mm-hmm. I think if they don't believe in it, the motivation's not there. Yeah. They turn the tape on and listen to it. But I don't think there's an engagement with the mm-hmm. process.
Well, I think that's the key word, engagement.
Yes.
I would suspect that if you've got a person who doesn't believe, they have in their stream of consciousness little thoughts cropping
yes.
up, this
right.
is nonsense, this is right. stupid, why am I wasting my time? That actually interferes with the visualization process. So you'd have to maybe train them to eliminate those thoughts first.
Exactly. They have to have a pretty sound commitment to mind-body connection.
Mm-hmm. Does it take a lot of training to get people to the level where they have this degree of control?
Let me tell you something. In dental surgery, the studies in dentistry have been out for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
One session was enough to create a situation where almost no blood was lost during wisdom tooth extraction.
No.
Children with hemophilia are remarkable in terms of quickly learning to image.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it takes a lot of effort, but it takes a presence, someone there that says to the patient, now listen, we're going to do this procedure on you. Could you just imagine for a moment, perhaps, that there'll be very little blood loss. Just put your mind in that place and imagine that you're only going to bleed the precise amount that you need to bleed in order to cleanse the wound. And that is sometimes all it takes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it must be a very delicate thing to understand who's receptive to that and who isn't.
It's a very delicate thing. And I listen. I have to listen for some time. Of course, people come to me, they're self-selecting because mm-hmm. they know about my work and they've read my books and things like that. But if they didn't, if they were walk-ins, as we call them, I would listen carefully for a couple of hours until I could find the entree into their belief system. They mm-hmm. don't need to find the entree into mine. I need to find the entree into theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's their religious faith, whether they pray in images and what those prayers might be like. And I think then I can work on the healing path.
I would think that, you know, with most people, the human mind is so complex that no matter how many parts of their attitudinal structure and their mental processes shut down, there'd almost always be a doorway somewhere.
Yes, there's a doorway somewhere. There's a success somewhere in their lives that they can relate to. There was some words, perhaps, that they heard when they were children. Mm-hmm. There's a doorway.
Mm-hmm. What else does the research literature tell us about imagery?
Well, the history of my research in this area started when I was observing some very interesting things in cancer patients. I observed some remarkable shift in their physiology that had absolutely nothing to do with the biological course of the disease. Mm-hmm. The first couple of months that I was working with Carl Simonton, I saw a man who was in liver failure literally go into remission. So I started to study those things. I thought that was probably the most remarkable instance of my entire postgraduate career, which had been about 9 months at that time. And what we found was that there are correlations, statistical correlations, between these images. And particularly when we've worked with people who are seriously ill, we've taken the images of their disease, the images of the treatment, and the image of any belief and any inner healing resources, and correlated those with recovery. And indeed they are. People who have the deep-seated inner belief that there's a healing force within also significantly outlive their life expectancy when given a difficult diagnosis. And we have replicated those studies with rheumatoid arthritis, with diabetes, et cetera, whatever, whatever government grants would allow us to do for many, many years. And I think the bottom line, as they say, is that the image is directly associated in whether a person gets sick and whether a person gets well. And beyond that, I don't know much.
But your earlier phrase, I want to come back to that, that people who are convinced that there's a healing force within them are the ones who do well with imagery.
Right.
Because if a person just goes through it and it's a ritual and they don't have a sense of the healing force within them, it may not work.
Right. And let me define work for myself and the way I see it. I'm not sure that the purpose of life is to live forever. So I'm not equating work necessarily with total recovery. Sometimes it is associated with total recovery. But I also like to think of working as being associated with few side effects from dangerous, difficult treatments. Dying with great grace and clarity, that's working as far as I'm concerned. Looking forward to another existence. And learning to believe in self at some level, whether that's the physical self that will get well or simply the self. So I think if you take all of those, if you embrace all of those under the definition of work, then yes.
I have heard some Buddhist teachers criticize some of the healing with imagery work because they say if a person is told they can heal themselves with imagery and then it doesn't work, then the person may tend to feel, oh, I'm a failure once again.
Right, right. That's the biggest criticism of the whole imagery field. And it comes, probably rightfully so, from physicians whose patients are knocking on their doors and saying, listen, I'm feeling worse than I ever did. I've been doing all this stuff and now I'm sick again. And they're beating themselves and chastising themselves. But I'll tell you this, that doesn't need to happen with good therapists. Very often it's a function of having not gone to a good therapist. And I also think that it is the price that all of us pay for self-reflection. Anybody who goes into psychotherapy for a time goes through a period of self-blame. We're a nation of people seeking meaning, and sometimes if you can blame something, you can put meaning on it. So I would really like to diffuse that criticism. It just is part of this whole complicated picture.
Right. So I guess when a person gets into that phase of self-blame, it may be valuable to work through it.
To work through it and say, what does this mean? And also, I always tell people, I don't have the answers. I don't know what cures cancer. I don't know what cures AIDS. I've been at this business a long, long time, and I think it is presumptuous for anyone to say, if you had just not had that thought, if you just not had that bad mother, that's a cause of a lot of this in this particular new age, then you wouldn't have gotten sick, or if you had just done this or eaten this. I don't have those answers.
Mm-hmm. But you seem to be implying that once more research is done, once we could say if you activate your T cells in a certain way that you can eliminate or severely attenuate the AIDS virus, then you could develop imagery procedures to accomplish that without drugs.
Apparently, the body-mind can do this. Mm-hmm. We don't have the answers from science yet that tell us what needs to be done from a pathophysiological standpoint or biological standpoint. And even then, I'm not sure that that would reverse major disease. But we do know that when people think about their heart slowing down, their hearts slow down. When people think about having more T cells in their body, they tend to have a major shift in T cells. We have that tentative evidence from science. What it means in the big picture of medicine is yet to be told.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Now, you seem very keen on the idea of particular imagery for particular physiological responses, but isn't it also the case that sort of generic imagery accomplishes much the same? If you get very relaxed and picture yourself in a peaceful, beautiful situation, imagining the happiest time in your life, that there are also physiological effects.
Major effects. And up until about 5 years ago, I thought that was probably what we were doing. We were giving people a wonderfully scientific way to relax. We were hooking them up to biofeedback. We were fairly precise on letting them design their own images, their own journeys. But then I started reading and doing some of this highly specific research. Yes, when you're relaxed, there is a general disinhibition. No, let me back up. When you're relaxed, the suppression on your immune system is somewhat lifted for people who are very anxious and probably not well. So the general relaxation obviously is very good for reestablishing vital signs that are normal and homeostasis and things like that. But I don't think just generally relaxing is going to make a wart go away. And I don't think just generally relaxing is going to cause a differential shift in certain components of the immune system that we've seen in some of our studies. So I think it's a both and. I think there is some great healing benefit to learning a quieting response or relaxation. But there may be more, especially for difficult problems. Yeah. There may be a deeper way that the body-mind can communicate with itself.
And sometimes this is quite intangible.
Yes.
You tell a wonderful story in your book. I wonder if you would repeat it about an experience that your daughter had with warts. Can you tell that
one? She'll love this. She must have been about 12 years old, 11 years old, and children of that age have a lot of warts. They're viral. They grow up overnight on their hands and feet. And I had just been working with Carl Simonton and Oscar Morfus in Fort Worth, and they were radiation oncologists. And they had sent her to a dermatologist, and I went with her. And he looked at me, and he said, "Jean," he said, "you know what you've been working with for these last few months." He said, "Magic is the treatment of choice for warts." He said, "If I burn them off or I cut them off, she's going to have scars for a long, long time." So I thought, well, magic, I know about magic. So we buried a rag at the crossroads by the light of the full moon and let it rot, and the warts didn't go away. And we turned widdershins, and we read all of these treatments from the books of magic. Didn't go away. So her grandparents, that summer, leased a big white horse. She went to the farm in Nebraska, got on the horse, and the next morning every one of those warts was gone. And she called it her wart horse. It was very clear to her that there was a connection. She was absolutely jubilant. And now we have names for this. We know that there's neuropeptides that probably begin to flow when people get on a big white horse and their fondest dream has come true.
Well, I guess part of it's, you know, it's hard to know how do you generalize from that experience to help people, but it sounds like there's a certain enthusiasm, a certain passion for the process that needs to be activated in some cases.
Exactly. And this process had nothing to do with mentally connecting with a wart. This was moving into a situation which brought such great joy that there was a tremendous metabolic shift in her little body. Mm-hmm. And we see that at Lourdes, we see that when people fall in love, we see it in all sorts of places, and it is a shift in self-image, a shift in the imagination.
Mm-hmm. It's as if what everybody has that key. For some people it will be spiritual, for other
exactly.
people it may be completely material or what might seem mundane or trivial to someone else, but if that's where the excitement is, that may be where they can mobilize these inner energies.
Yes, you wouldn't believe what I've seen people use to keep themselves alive with. And their paths are their paths. As uh-huh. they say, there's a whole lot of ways up that mountain. And again, I think that's where the good therapist, the good family member plays a role, is in listening to what that path is mm-hmm. and sharing it.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that people who have a sense of spiritual connection, a sense of connection with the infinite, tend to be more adept at the visualization work?
Not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bouquet of flowers out there in the human community, and I'm not so sure that I always see that. It's interesting, though, we've been doing a lot of work in Argentina, mm-hmm. and Argentina is a primary example of a country that is in economic shambles.
Yes.
They're very literate, very well-educated, mm-hmm. very psychologically oriented, mm-hmm. and the medical system is in shambles with the rest of the system, and so we've been going down there and teaching imagery. They have rich religious imagery from Catholicism. Mm-hmm. They're using the Eye of God, they're using Virgin Marys instead of the kind of images that we get here,
mm-hmm.
but it took about 2 hours, and their eyes lit up. We did the first workshop for several hundred people, and they said, yes, of course that works.
Uh-huh.
So that, for us, is a prototype of a perfect situation where people are educated, they have very, very rich background for doing imagery, and they're using it as a healing tool.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jean Ochterberg, it's such a pleasure to be able to converse with someone whose experience and knowledge in this field is so deep. And for those of you listening now, you may be interested in knowing that this discussion will be part of a Thinking Aloud Inner Work videotape, along with an additional hour of discussion going into greater depth. Jean, thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you.
And thank you for being with us.